Listener discretion is advised.
What should have been a fun lead up to the group's first Special Olympics tournament as a team transformed into a nightmare of unknowns that in many ways has never ended since.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to True Crime. Today's episode is from the podcast Yuba County 5. I'm Greg, the host and curator of True Crime. Every week, I find a true crime episode that I think you will love from an independent podcast creator. In February 1978, five young men, all with varying degrees of cognitive disabilities, inexplicably drive deep into the Sierra Nevada mountains and are never seen alive again. Yuba County 5 is a very bingeable podcast, and I hope you really enjoy this first episode. If you do, check the episode description for links to subscribe. All right, we're going to get this show started after a quick word from our sponsors.
Have you heard about the 2018 study that showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? No? Well, now you have. I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual, the company making traceability the new standard in the supplement industry. I remember staring at my prenatal vitamins and finding all these things I was trying to avoid: high amounts of heavy metals, synthetic colorants, and unnecessary ingredients. So, at 4 months pregnant, I quit my job and started Ritual because I believe that all women deserve to know what they're putting in their bodies and why. I'm so proud of our prenatal vitamin. The ingredients are 100% traceable, it's third-party tested for microbes and heavy metals, and recently received the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. You see, we trace like a mother because, let's be honest, no one cares quite like a mother. But don't just take my word for it. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/prenatal.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Begin.
Mopac Audio.
This show contains adult language, discussions of drug abuse, and historical terminology that some may find offensive. Please take care while listening.
It was a Friday evening in the winter of 1978 in the Northern California college town of Chico. In a sparse visitor section of a large gymnasium, sat five young men who had just driven an hour to watch their favorite team, the UC Davis Aggies, beat the Chico State Wildcats. This win was a good omen for them because the following day, the men were playing in a basketball tournament of their own for the Special Olympics. But on the drive home from Chico, something happened, and all five men inexplicably vanished.
I remember thinking so much about the darkness of when they disappeared.
These are five guys who went an hour in the wrong direction into the mountains.
He said, "You're never going to find him. He's at the bottom of Orville Lake."
I noticed the roads were booby-trapped. And then we see the guys with guns. We got out of there. We got scared.
What were they doing there? To this day, we don't know.
They just said, no, we're not going to do any more searching. And that was the end of it. And we sat back for 40 years and waited.
In the 4 decades since Gary, Ted, Jackie, Bill, and Jack disappeared, many have been quick to dismiss this case as open and shut, a simple tragedy involving five men who, because of their intellectual disabilities, just took a wrong turn and got lost in the mountains. But when you take the time to understand these men, who they were, the places that shaped them, and the people who loved them, and their differences, it becomes apparent that simply getting lost could have never happened. Someone or something had to have forced them up there. I'm Shannon McGarvey, a writer and producer whose team has spent 4 years investigating the disappearance of the Yuba County Five. And over the next 7 episodes, I'll explore the little-known details of this case in an effort to cut through the mystery of what actually happened that night, and hopefully bring us all a bit closer to the truth. This is the Yuba County 5 Podcast. About an hour north of Sacramento, in the shadow of the distant Sierra Nevada mountain range, on opposite banks of the scenic Feather River, sits Yuba and Sutter, two of California's oldest counties. In the late 1840s, the Yuba-Sutter area became the epicenter of the California Gold Rush, and combined with the virgin timber of the Sierras, transformed the area into a well of seemingly endless prosperity. And the Yuba County seat of Marysville, which was named after a survivor of the snowbound Donner Party, was at the heart of it all. But by the 20th century, prospecting for gold and timber had given way to a different kind of industry, agriculture. During the Great Depression of the 1920s and 30s, the lush, fertile flatlands of communities such as Yuba and Sutter drew thousands of refugee farmers, like the family of retired Yuba County Captain of Detectives Avery Blankenship, from the drought-stricken Midwest looking for work.
My folks and myself, we migrated in the 30s from Oklahoma to California. We became known as Okies. I'm an Okie from Muskogee kind of thing. They were tough people, and thus the crime rate was higher in Yuba County, and we had a lot of problems there.
But eventually, the drought came to Northern California, too. 1977 was the driest year on record, and when combined with a regional dependence on agricultural work, it made Yuba one of the poorest, and consequently most crime-riddled, counties in the state.
My name is Jack Beecham. I was the undersheriff of Yuba County from 1977 through 1979. We have one area at that particular time that had more felons per capita than any place in the state. It was a particularly tough area.
A lot of it was drugs. A lot of it was the hippie era from the 60s carrying over into the 70s. The population that grew up in Yuba County from the migrants that came there in the 30s committed a lot of crime.
In the 1970s, the Yuba-Sutter area saw a surge in violent crime, ranging from assault to armed robbery to arson attacks and even serial murder.
And it just made for an interesting situation if you're in law enforcement.
That's historian and archivist Tony Wright, whose book Things Aren't Right, The Disappearance of the Yuba County Five is forthcoming.
You know, Marysville is a nice, quiet place, but some of these surrounding communities, there's some tough guys in that area. There's some crazy people up there as well.
It was in one of those surrounding communities, the rough working-class Yuba County suburb of Olivehurst, where one of the missing men, 25-year-old Gary Mathias, spent his formative years. Gary's youngest sister, Tammy, says it was a strange place to grow up.
Olivehurst was more like a ghost town. You didn't even have cops out there because it was like really weird. No street lights, at dark, nobody wanted to be out.
Gary was the first of 4 children born to Ida Mosley and Garland Mathias.
Gary was the oldest, then it was Sharon, Mark, and then me. He loved the song, Tammy's in Love. And so when my mother became pregnant, he said, if the baby's a girl, I want her name to be Tammy. So that's who I am.
My name is Jess Smith. I'm a nurse, I'm a mom, and I'm Gary Mathias's niece. My mom, Sharon Mathias, was Gary's sister.
Gary's mother, Ida, and his biological father, Garland, separated early in his life. Eventually, Ida began a relationship with a man named Bob Klopf, the person who became the Mathias children's principal father figure.
They were an amazing couple. He really loved my grandma. He raised those kids as his own. My uncle Gary was a quiet man. He was very kind. He was very loving.
Gary was very kind-hearted. He helped everybody. He loved to sing. He had his own band called The Fifth Shade, and he was the lead singer.
He liked to write, very artsy, which makes sense because that's how my family is. He loved his sister, loved his brother.
We were very close since I was little. Used to walk me to the bus stop because we had caught the buses at the same places. He'd go to the high school and I'd go to the elementary or the middle school, and he was always protective of me because I was his, as he used to say, I was his baby.
During his high school years, Gary's name was mentioned several times in local newspapers for his accomplishments on the football field. He was a gifted athlete, despite having double vision without his glasses. In 1971, after Gary graduated from high school, he enlisted in the United States Army and served in the Vietnam War.
He was in Vietnam for a while, and he went to Germany, where he had some issues there, where he was given illegal drugs and found passed out in the streets.
My uncle was in Germany, and he did have some sort of mental health breakdown at that time. I do know that at one point he was diagnosed as a schizophrenic.
Gary's abuse of certain types of drugs may have contributed to his schizophrenia.
That's author Tony Wright.
The best way I could probably describe it, if you're familiar with the band Pink Floyd, they had a member named Syd Barrett. Syd Barrett's use of LSD was just unbelievable, and it led to his schizophrenia.
According to experts, the causes of schizophrenia are much like the disorder itself, mysterious. But some risk factors include family history, birth complications, as well as the use of mind-altering drugs, such as LSD, during teen and young adult years.
He was later shipped back to the United States, where he was admitted into mental health down in Napa County.
They got him into a special place that they thought was going to maybe help him more than they could help him. So they drove. That was a lot for them. And dropped him off. You want to go? I want to go. Okay. You know, very calm. We're all in agreement. They have a meeting with the people down there. Everything is great. They drive home. And they're home for half an hour, and he walks through their door. And my grandma said, I about came unglued. My grandpa just started laughing and said, and this is how they talked, how the hell did you get here? And he said, I took the train and I just jumped right off the tracks right here. He jumped on a train and rode it all the way there. So what kind of function level do you think my uncle had to be able to do that?
According to police reports, that incident happened sometime in 1974. The following year, Gary stabilized briefly with the help of medication and signed up for courses at Yuba College, against the advice of his stepfather, Bob. Eventually, though, it was all too much for Gary, and he began failing out of school. And instead of facing Bob, he ran away to his grandmother's house in Oregon, where he had some kind of episode. Here's Drew Beeson, author of the 2020 book, Out of Bounds, What Happened to the Yuba County Five.
He was up in Portland, Oregon, visiting his grandmother and was living with her for a short period of time and wound up walking all the way home. And we don't know if he ever hitchhiked or not. Gary's own account was that he walked that entire distance, living off milk left on porches, cat and dog food left outside.
For reference, the distance between Portland, Oregon and Olivehurst is almost 550 miles, an incredible, almost unbelievable journey to make by foot and without any financial means to sustain himself.
He come knocked on the door. My stepfather answered the door and he said, I don't know who you are, but I think I'm supposed to be here.
After a few of these incidents, Gary finally got on a medication regimen that, according to his family, seemed to work. Tammy says that he was doing really well and the symptoms of his schizophrenia were under control.
He came home and he was doing psych therapy, and the psychologist that he was going to see recommended that Gary join this program and learn a trade other than what he had picked up in the military.
It was at that point, Tammy says, Gary joined the mental health program at the Gateway Projects, a local organization that helped people with disabilities, mental health conditions, and addiction find work and community support.
They helped Gary to manage financially. If he did get a job, they taught him how to log everything that you'd spent or keep records. It was just something to help them to get by with life.
So when Gary was there with his counselor knew that Gary Mathias had played football at Marysville High School and was a pretty good athlete in his own right. This is how the guys came to know each other. They played on a basketball team sponsored by that program called the Gateway Gators.
But Gary Mathias already knew at least one of the other men, or boys as many of their families called them, who would later go missing. 32-year-old Ted Weir lived a few doors down from Gary's family in Olivehurst, so the two men had grown up in each other's orbit. This is Ted's nephew, Dallas Weir Jr., discussing his family's roots in the area.
My grandfather, Robert L. Weir, with my grandmother, Imogene, moved the kids there in 1946 or 7. Bought 2 acres, built a little tar paper shack, and that's where my Uncle Ted grew up.
Based on conversations with other members of the Weir family, author Tony Wright paints a warm picture of Ted.
In describing Ted, he's just a big, fun-loving guy. Always was waving at people, generally friendly, a very kind-hearted man.
He had a heart of gold, very kind, very generous, very giving, just fun, loved to laugh, make his nephews and nieces laugh. He'd pick me up by the arm and the leg, and he'd do the twirl me around like an airplane thing, about pull your arm out of your socket.
Ted was a big guy, 6 feet tall, 200 pounds, and in high school, always excelled in sports.
He could throw a ball a mile. I mean, a softball, whatever, it didn't matter what it was. He could throw and hit a ball a mile. He just naturally gifted in baseball and loved to play sports.
Ted had an incredibly active lifestyle and won numerous gold and silver medals in basketball and track at Special Olympics competitions around the state.
Just didn't have common sense. So therefore, he didn't have a license, driver's license. Couldn't get the concept of, why do I have to stop? Well, there's a stop sign there, Ted. You're supposed to stop at a stop sign. But why?
With Ted, his family have sort of developed a theory that if he were diagnosed today, he would probably be on the autism spectrum.
And he would drive my dad crazy with questions at night, lying in bed. He'd say, they called my dad Wayne. Wayne, why do you think Mickey Mantle can hit a ball farther than I can? Well, Ted, he's good. He's better than you. That's why, Ted. Why are you worried about it? Go to sleep. We got to get up and go to work tomorrow with Dad. So, you know, just things of that nature.
Ted was a nice guy. He was sweet. He was very caring. But he would ask questions, why do I need to do this? Why do I need to do that?
This lack of common sense often translated to potentially disastrous circumstances.
A funny story. My aunt, Dolores, was driving somewhere and she pulled up the stop sign. Look, she said, Ted, are there any cars coming? And he said, no. And she started out and had hit the brakes because there was a truck coming. She said, I asked you if anything was coming. He said, you asked me if it was a car, damn it. And it was a truck.
Ted, like many people on the autism spectrum, had trouble reading social cues, interpreting nuance, and controlling certain impulses.
He seems a bit impulsive and sort of, I don't want to say bad decisions, but almost lacking in impulse control at times.
He was high functioning as far as, you know, he could hold down a job. Once you trained him and you showed him how to do it, he could do repetitious things and was very good at that. I remember him being a janitor at, I believe, Yuba Gardens Middle School. He had worked with my dad some. He'd cut firewood and whatnot.
Ted sort of had to be micromanaged by family because I talked to someone in his family about, you know, you guys went out hunting. Did Ted go hunting? And he was like, if we went hunting, we wouldn't give Ted a rifle. There was no way we would give Ted a loaded weapon.
I mean, he couldn't hunt because that common sense thing, you might get shot if you gave him a gun.
Whereas guns might have been off limits for Ted, he had plenty of other interests.
He absolutely adored women. Wouldn't hardly talk to them, but he liked to look at them, that's for sure. He loved to listen to the radio. As he's getting ready in the bathroom, you could hear him in there with the radio on and just why this song comes to my mind, but rubber band man. And he'd be in the shower and he'd be singing. He loved his Pepsis. He would go and get him an 8-pack of Pepsis. Those were Uncle Ted's Pepsis. Bowling was one of the big things, too, that they really loved to do.
Ted and his best friend Jackie Hewitt did almost everything together, from Special Olympics competitions, basketball games, and even work. They wound cable for the Pacific Gas and Electric Company, PG&E, a job they got through the Gateway Projects. At 24, Jackie was the youngest member of the group and kind of like a little brother to Ted.
Jackie Hewitt was always with Uncle Ted. I didn't really get to see him too very much. But, you know, just a sweet, very simple man that didn't say a lot, but just smiled, wanted to be out, wanted to live, wanted to be autonomous and have his own life, but yet definitely was not able to.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah. Oh. Sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Jackie, another one of the missing men, was the first child of Jack and Sarah Hewitt, who met in Eureka, California in 1950. Here's Jack Sr., who passed away in 2019.
We went together for 2 years, and now he's married. She just walking down the street, and I was headed to town, give her a lift. Lasted for 70 years.
For the first 2 years of Jackie's life, Jack Sr. was stationed overseas with the U.S. Army.
I never seen him till he was 2 years old. I was in Germany. And I knew the minute I was home, he wasn't right. Because he wouldn't have nothing to do with me at all. If I'd just come in the room where he was at, he'd just scream.
Back then, they called him retarded. To me, that's not the word for it. You know, it's more autistic or something.
That's Tom Hewitt, Jackie's youngest brother. The word retarded, and any of its iterations, is now part of a largely taboo and pejorative vernacular. But throughout much of the 20th century, the term mentally retarded or mental retardation was a medical diagnosis given to people with intellectual disabilities.
I talked to his doctor about it, and his doctor said he was retarded. It took 4 or 5 years for him to get used to me. They ended up putting him in a special school here. And he liked it. He couldn't write. He could print. Not very good, but he could do it.
He worked. Went to school, just like everybody else. He was always happy, liked everybody, didn't like any kind of conflict, and everybody liked him. Everybody stood up for him, no matter what was going on.
Jackie was also severely asthmatic, which caused the Hewitts to move from the cool coastal city of Eureka to the hotter, drier temperatures of Olivehurst.
When he was 14 years old, he only weighed about 110 pounds. He told us move to a hot country and it'd help him. Well, a year later, he weighed 220. I was glad we did.
Even with Jackie's differences, his mother, Sarah, who passed away in 2018, made sure to treat all of her kids the same. Her daughter-in-law, Claudia, remembers her fondly.
They had a very strong family value, and she was going to raise Jackie just like she would any of her other kids. I don't necessarily think that her bond with Jackie was any more or any less. But there is something special about a firstborn. That child is the one that makes your mother.
To me, he wasn't that different. And to my wife, maybe and his brother and sisters, they didn't think he was that bad.
It's a very tight-knit family. You don't hear I love yous very often and get hugs and things like that, but it doesn't mean it's not there.
We had a normal brother-to-brother relationship. he was more of a homebody than my brother and sister that were in the middle. They were in their teens doing their thing, and I was still too young to go out and just run amok like they did. So we were home more together.
As younger kids, they were forced to go hunting and ride in the back of cars on trips, and they would fight like normal siblings, treat each other like normal siblings, but they loved each other.
Again, here's author Tony Wright.
Jackie, according to his family, may have had the mental capacity of a 13-year-old boy. He probably wasn't great at reading and writing, but he could ride a motorcycle.
Then he decided he wanted a motorcycle. Well, he got it. He went through a 6-foot fence first day. Tore half our swimming pool down.
On another occasion, a highway patrolman caught Jackie riding that same motorcycle down the freeway.
And then he brought him home. He says, "Is this your son?" I said, "Yeah." "He doesn't have a license." I said, "I know that." "Is he retarded?" I said, "Yes." "Ah, forget it," he said. Just drove up. I told him, I said, "When you get on the road, you stay on the edge of the road, not down the middle of it." And he did.
When he was a teenager, Jackie got connected with the Gateway Projects, which is how he got a job at PG&E with Ted Weir.
PG&E put him to work. It made a heck of a difference to these kids. They'd get up in the morning, and my son especially, "You don't have to go to work today." "Oh, yes, I do. You don't take me all wrong." "Anyway, it's only 2 miles. You know." But all of them are like that. He got a job, he get paid for it.
My brother hung out with Ted the most. And then the others, they went to games and did stuff together, but Jackie and Ted were always together.
First friend he had was that Ted Weir. They couldn't do nothing by themselves. They had to be together. And they stuck up for each other. And then somebody would try to be a smart ass to them or something, they'd just walk away. It'd been you or me, we'd probably hook some ass. They wouldn't do it. They didn't believe in hurting anybody.
They loved to go to basketball games and watch college basketball games and stuff like that. All the boys did.
And I never seen two kids walk as far as they would. They could outwalk me any day. Very seldom even ask you to take them somewhere. They just say, "Well, I'm going, I'll be back." You know, take off.
Jackie had an active social life, despite not having a driver's license. According to family, he even had a girlfriend named Ruth, and they'd sometimes meet up at Gateway dances, but most often as a group with Ted, Bill Sterling, and Jack Madruga.
These were just 5 very close friends who enjoyed active lifestyles of playing basketball or playing mini golf or bowling. They had a great time together.
Bill Sterling was known as the quiet coordinator of the group. He organized weekly basketball practice for the men. He was active in the local Christian singles community and was a star bowler on one of the area's oldest bowling teams for people with disabilities, the Pin Pickers.
Bill Sterling is probably the toughest one because of all the people I've talked to, I just don't have anyone from the Sterling family that knew him or friends and family that are willing to talk about this case.
Most of what is known about Bill and the Sterling family can be pieced together from newspaper articles and public records.
The Sterling family just has no interest in talking about the case. Is it privacy? Possibly. Is there a point where you just are tired of talking the case? That's another possibility as well.
The Sterling family suffered a series of tragedies, which might account for why the family doesn't want to revisit its history. Some memories are just too painful to dredge up.
I know his brother was killed in a motorcycle accident, and I know Bill's dad died tragically in a drowning accident as well. So I can understand with all the family trauma that it's probably just too much to deal with, and it's probably really difficult to talk about.
Bill's parents, Juanita and Jim, met at a dance in 1948 and were married the same year. Yuba County Sheriff's Department records state that Juanita claimed Bill was borderline retarded. And when Bill was around 11 years of age, she sent him to the Napa State Hospital, just north of the San Francisco Bay Area, for hyperactivity. Though the terms of his stay at Napa are unclear, Bill would have likely been admitted to Napa's adolescent treatment program around 1960 and would have left the care of the facility by approximately 1968.
For me, it's a bit interesting to see Bill institutionalized for hyperactivity. I've always felt that the full narrative surrounding Bill Sterling has never been out, and we just don't have enough information on him to paint a clear picture.
For context, throughout the 19th and 20th centuries, and as late as the 1960s and 70s, it was not uncommon for doctors to recommend institutionalization of children and adults for any number of reasons.
Business troubles, childbirth, use of opium, typhoid fever, sunstroke.
That's Lauren Coodley, a retired professor of psychology and history, who is also the author of several books about the history of the Napa Valley.
An excessive study. Those were the stated grounds on which people could be admitted.
Lauren worked at Napa State Hospital in the late 1970s.
I was working exclusively with women who had been abused by people in their lives and who were trying to figure out literally how to live, how to make sense of the trauma they had experienced. I wouldn't call any of them mentally ill, frankly. I would call them trauma victims.
When the Napa State Hospital first opened in 1875, it was founded on the principles of moral treatment and largely regarded as a place of healing through the therapeutic benefits of wide open spaces and resident labor. But by the 1960s, work therapy had been replaced by the use of psychotropic drugs. But Lauren says the children's and adolescent units of Napa always remained a bright spot at the hospital.
It had a very good reputation in the town of Napa because it was still treating children from the town of Napa as well as children from outside. The most dedicated social workers, I think, wanted to work in the children's and adolescent unit because they felt that there was more opportunity for genuine therapy and healing to happen. So it was a very popular, beloved unit.
By the end of the 1960s, Bill was released from the care of Napa and was able to graduate from Placer High School in Auburn, California, a suburb of Sacramento. Around 1971, Bill worked in a restaurant at nearby Beale Air Force Base until his mother made him quit because airmen were allegedly getting him drunk and taking his money. Though the timeline for when Bill became involved with the Gateway Projects is unclear, it was assumed that he met his best friend, Jack Madruga, there. Jack lived across the river from Bill, about 20 miles to the north, on a sizable piece of land he shared with his family. Jack Madruga was born to Melba Gail Wiley and Antone Tony Madruga on June 18, 1947, in Marysville. Melba was a housewife, and Tony was a truck driver who worked in road construction.
We were very close. We were a close family. We lived in the foothills here out of Marysville, a place called Loma Rica.
That's the voice of Kathy Madruga, Jack Madruga's niece. Her dad was Jack's older brother, George Sr.
And our grandmother, Madruga, her and my uncle lived in the old ranch house on top of a hill. And my dad and mom built a home down the road from him. Grandma gave my dad some acreage. So we all grew up together.
Kathy says every member of the Madruga family had a nickname, and her uncle Jack's was Doc. Here's Kathy's younger brother, George Jr.
When he was younger, he'd watch cartoons and he'd go around saying, "What's up, Doc? What's up, Doc?" And it just stuck to him.
Valerie Atia, Jack's niece, remembers visiting from Nevada as a child.
He was a good uncle. He always took us places when we were up there, whether it be to go into town to Marysville to see a movie, or I know between him and my grandmother and my aunt, we swam in every swimming hole, reservoir, lake, and river up in that area because that's what we would do all summer long.
He was a quiet guy. He was very sensitive and very smart, too. That's one thing that never comes out is he was smart. People assume since he was so quiet that he was not all there, but he was extremely intelligent and fun-loving, loved to play games, very much into sports and basketball.
He loved sports. He played sports. He used to go to all those games all the time, take us, and we'd go. We just did a lot of things together. Like I said, we were close.
Growing up, life on the ranch was fun, but also a lot of hard work. After Jack graduated from Marysville High School in 1965, George says he primarily worked on their family property.
He did, you know, work around the house there and work around the land. He helped us plow the fields and stuff and grade the roads.
But then, sometime around 1966, the simplicity and security of Jack's insular life in the hills was all threatened by a letter from the United States Army.
We were down at my parents' house, got the letter in the mail, and he just kind of choked up and go, "What's wrong?" And then I do remember him crying. He said, "I got drafted," and then he went back up to his house. That's what I remember that distinctly. And I remember crying too because, you know, I got drafted.
The year after Jack graduated from high school, the United States military drafted over 382,000 young men to serve in the Vietnam War. It was the single largest number of conscripts for any year in the nearly 20-year conflict until the draft was abolished in 1973. For many draftees, selective service was as good as a death sentence. Within the military, they were sometimes referred to as bullet catchers, a slang term for those sent to the infantry front lines, surely to die or come back maimed. But George says his uncle was one of the lucky few.
He did not go overseas. I think he stayed back east somewhere. He stayed here in the state.
According to case files, Jack performed at an average capability before being honorably discharged in 1968. Here's author Tony Wright.
I see in the papers where they don't believe he was diagnosed with anything, but I do know that he was seeking medical or professional help during the 70s on a limited basis.
Family members told officials that Jack was introverted and considered to be slow in his thought processes, but never a discipline problem. He even attended Yuba College for a while after a stint in the Army and used his allotment to purchase a new car.
He had a love for his car, a 1969 Mercury Montego two-door blue and white car.
He loved that car. That was his baby.
No one could really drive his vehicles. He was very meticulous, and he kept his vehicles in top shape.
After his discharge from the military, Jack continued to live at home with his mother and paid half of all the household bills. In the mid-70s, he worked as a dishwasher in the cafeteria of the dried fruit company Sunsweet with Bill Sterling until they both got laid off. It's unclear if the men got the Sunsweet job through the Gateway Projects, but it is very likely the organization that brought them together.
But they were all nice guys. That's about all I know about them, and Doc liked them a lot, and they did things together a lot, I guess.
Around this time, Doc, Bill, Jackie, Ted, and Gary had been spending more time together as a group while practicing for an upcoming Special Olympics tournament in the nearby town of Rocklin. But there was only one catch. Their favorite basketball team, the UC Davis Aggies, was playing at Chico State the night before the Gateway Gators' big game.
In fact, he called me when I was living in Fresno before this all happened. He wanted to come down and visit with me, and I was going out of town for that weekend. And he said, "Well, you're brushing me off." I said, "No." He goes, "Are you embarrassing me and my friends?" And I said, "Well, no. Why would I be?" I said, "Of course not." And that was the last time I spoke to Doc, and I feel guilty about it.
In a situation like this, guilt is understandable. But no one could have imagined what unfolded after the men left the game at Chico State that Friday night. What should have been a fun lead up to the group's first Special Olympics tournament as a team transformed into a nightmare of unknowns that in many ways has never ended since.
Around roughly 2 a.m., Bill Sterling's mom, Juanita, wakes up with a sense of dread, like, Bill's not home. Where is
he? We found out the next morning, and the wife called me at the job and said, "Them boys are missing."
The first day I thought, well, maybe they're just doing something. And then it started dawning on everybody, wow, something's not right.
Somehow that car winds up an hour and a half off course in the Plumas National Forest.
In my heart, I feel they were forced. There's no doubt about that in my mind.
The question is, what were they doing there? To this day, we don't know.
In the next episode, the mystery continues to deepen. Episode 2 is available for download now. If you like the Yuba County 5 podcast, please take a moment to leave a 5-star rating and a review, and be sure to tell your friends. Mopac Audio also has two other podcasts you might like. Lisk, Long Island serial killer, and An Absurd Result. Follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you stream. Find the show on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Yuba Podcast. That's at Yuba Podcast. Or online at yubapodcast.com. Thanks for listening. This has been a MOPAC audio production. Our executive producers are Jonathan Nauzardin and Jonathan Beal. Chris Moss is supervising producer. Julian Singleton is our research and archival coordinator. And I'm Shannon McGarvey, writer and senior producer. Editing and music by Blake Maples.
Thanks again for listening to True Crime by Indie Drop-In. If you would like your show featured, reach out to us at Indie Drop-In on all social media or go to indiedropin.com. See you next time.